session number 25186, reel 7.
Ronald, Jesse, reel 7. When you arrived on board the Belfast in 1943, you described your living conditions as fairly basic. You were living or sleeping in your workshop. Did that remain the case during the 5 years or so, or 4 years, that you were aboard the Belfast?
Well, no. The living conditions improved considerably in the Pacific Theatre. For to start with, the numbers carried on board ship were down, first of all, to full war complement, whereas in the European theatre we had carried people on under training as well as full war complement. For instance, the five of us apprentices who joined the artificer's mess under training were supernumerary. In the Pacific Theatre, we were just full war complement to start with, and this decreased at the end of the war conditions to strong peacetime complement, which means you could steam with three watches, and you could fire with two guns out of three in each turret. So the numbers were down. In addition to this, in preparing the ship for operations in the Pacific Ocean, a full-scale laundry had been fitted underneath the catapult deck. The catapult deck was no longer necessary, as the walrus planes had been dispensed with. The hangars were converted into, one hangar was converted into extra offices and messes, and the other hangar had been converted into a very versatile theatre. It could be used for any number of things, but basically the open space was retained. And underneath the catapult deck was installed this full-scale laundry and a much improved kitchen facility. Also, the ship was big enough to carry a full-scale platoon of Marines and a Marine band, and the Marine band were very much in use in restoring confidence to the dominions around the periphery of the Pacific.
Can I ask you about your living conditions in a bit more detail? For example, once you'd lost your supernumerary element,
yes,
were you able to sleep in a mess?
Yes. I had achieved a certain amount of seniority, and instead of sleeping in the workshop, I was able to have a billet in the mess. And you appreciate that when the hammocks are slung, they more or less touch each other. And there's a certain art in getting in and out of them. But nevertheless, being in the mess is very much more comfortable, in as much as you have it's less noisy, it's cleaner, it's got improved mounting and demounting, and as much as you can jump up off a table or a messing form. You have a good lighting facilities, as you can lay in your hammock and read a book quite comfortably, and then dim the light down and put the book on a cable tray and be nice and cosy once you're in your hammock. You have somewhere to keep your clothes clean and tidy, in as much as one has a locker. I had a locker in the mess, quite close to where my hammock was. All in all, very much more comfortable.
You mentioned the laundry.
The worry of keeping your clothes clean and ironed and dried is taken away by the fact that there's a laundry. And soon after the end of hostilities, we took on board Dobie Wallers, that is to say Chinese men from Hong Kong, who would run the laundry and launder the shirts. And shirts, for instance, could be put out for laundry and returned the next day, fully washed, dried and ironed, and quite nicely ironed too. There were servants for the officers, excuse me, stewards that attended to the wardroom necessities and waited on visitors when we had parties coming on board. They would have a little white jacket, the stewards would have a little white jacket and rush round with hors d'oeuvres and drinks for the parties on the quarter deck beneath the awning, all very British, and they kept up a much higher standard of cuisine than our ordinary ship's cooks and stewards could have done. For instance, one of my duties in this time was to look after refrigerators and air conditioners, and the early crude air conditioners were just beginning to come into use. And that was my job to look after them. And refrigerators were jammed into every conceivable corner to so that we could take a lot more food around whilst we were at sea than we could from the normal ship's stores.
What were the catering arrangements as far as you were concerned?
Catering was the same as it had always been as a general principle, that is to say, our two messmen prepared any dishes of food that they could prepare, such as potatoes and cabbages and vegetables, and look after the bread. These dishes of food were taken to the galley, it was cooked in the galley, and collected again at mealtime by the messmen, who served the meals onto plates and kept them in a hot cupboard, so that whatever time the members of the mess came for their meal, it would be there ready for them hot. If you were going, for instance, on the afternoon watch at 12 o'clock, you could demand your dinner at 11:30, and there it would be all ready for you, because that's allowed for in the system of things. Ordinarily, you packed up work at 12 o'clock, and midday meal was served at 12:30. Tot time was 11 o'clock.
Tell me about the tot.
Yes, the tot. Neat rum of a gill quantity was served out by messes, by the numbers in a mess. And in our case, our chief engineer artificer, who was the president of the mess, he would collect our ration, or rather it would be collected for him by the messman and brought his attention, and he would preside at the end of the table with the fanny full of rum, and dish it out with a measure into a glass for each member, who would be ceremoniously ticked off on a list. You were required by law to drink it then and there. It was accepted practice that if you wanted to, you poured half of it into a little bottle and kept your your rum store in your locker. If somebody had done you a good favour, it was either a sipper's reward or a gulper's reward, in which case a sip is as it describes a sip, and a gulp is as it describes a gulp, and some people's gulp was bigger than others. And on very rare occasions, it was the whole tot as it came as a reward. And this was the scratching of back, scratching backs arrangement that worked extremely well and lubricated life on board ship no end. If one was on watch in the engine room, one was relieved of one's watch to go to the mess at rum time and accept one's drink of rum. It's noted that the station keeping of ships from 11 to 12 o'clock was noticeably haphazard as engines went faster and slower in the next hour, because it did make you decidedly wobbly. Some people got rowdy at this time of the day, and you could always recognise it and keep out of their way. The food I remember was always of excellent quality. Breakfast, for instance, was bacon, eggs, and tomatoes. Tin tomatoes, tis true, but it was a very, very, very acceptable meal. And white bread, always, with lots of butter, and that is a big change when you've been used to brown. Almost grey bread, which was the ration ration ashore in wartime. Tea was hot and strong and plentiful. Kai, that's cocoa, was always available in the night watches, and it was kept in a great big vat in the kitchen, and you could go and ladle yourself out cocoa in any quantity you fancied. The middle watch was something special. The middle watch is midnight to 4 a.m. And if you were destined to keep the middle watch, you and your colleagues had a little plan where somebody was to collect the vegetables, the potato and the onion. Somebody else was to collect a tin of corned beef or some other meaty choice ingredient. Somebody was to collect a tin of soup or even two tins of soup, and the whole engine room contributed something. And this went into a fanny in the engine room with water and was cooked by putting a portable piece of copper piping made by the coppersmith onto a steam drain, and the valve turned on, and the end of this piece of pipe was put into the soup, and it was growled for about an hour, and it was delicious. Everybody, no matter whether he was an officer of the watch or the merest stoker, had equal rations, and it passed the time, passed the watch time away most deliciously. For some reason, it was no good trying to do it in the first watch. That's the 8 o'clock to 12 o'clock, because nobody was hungry enough. And it was absolutely useless trying to do it in the morning watch, 4 o'clock to 8 o'clock. You just hadn't got the stomach for anything at that ungodly hour. And 4 o'clock, incidentally, is the truly nadir time in one's daily cycle, one's clock. That's when you are really at your worst. And if anybody ever wanted to put in an attack at the best time of the day, that would be the best time, because nobody is fit for anything at 4 o'clock in the morning. The rest of catering, tea was a bit of a non-starter, just bread and jam and cake occasionally. And except you saved something, there was nothing ever available in between times. Nothing like biscuits or coffee in the morning or anything like that. It was just these plain breakfast, dinner and tea. You could make a cup of tea. Our mess had a little kitchen, little wash-up place with a hot cupboards attached to it, and you could go in there and make a cup of tea in the evening if there were rations enough available. But that was about all.
Did you get food from other sources, for example, the Naffy?
You could buy things like tins of soup and chocolate and packets of biscuits, but that's all. Nothing in any quantity. It was writing paper envelopes, cigarettes, shaving gear, toilet gear, and that sort of thing in the Naffy. During the 2 years that I was in the Pacific arena, steps were taken to set up shoreside Naffies in Singapore, Hong Kong, Shanghai, one in Tokyo, so that when ships were in harbour, they could go ashore and use a Naffies facilities. But it was a long time in the developing, and I don't ever remember using such a facility in my time in the Pacific.
Can I ask you about naval traditions on the Belfast? For example, Sunday divisions.
Yes, Sunday divisions was a must. And I don't think I ever remember not wanting to go to division. Some people regarded Sunday divisions with horror, but providing your clothing was in good order and your boots were, your shoes were clean, and you kept yourself to scratch, it was no hardship. Some people were slovenly and could never find a clean shirt or tie and were always scrounging things to make themselves look presentable, and they always tried to get out of Sunday divisions and find some excuse for not being there, but it never bothered me. I liked Sunday divisions. I thought it was a time when everybody showed themselves at their best. And I also liked the church service afterwards. I remember one Sunday divisions at sea. We were travelling from, it was not on the Belfast, it was on the Keene, but it's the same sort of thing. We were travelling across the Indian Ocean, and it was a smooth day, and the ship was just rolling gently from side to side. And the ship's company was mustered on the quarter deck for a church service, and singing hymns with the ship rocking from side to side is something I remember to this day, including the hymns. Our division, the engine room artificers mustered on the port side in the waist, and the chief engine room artificer gave the orders and presented us to our divisional officer, and he walked along and looked at us, and we looked at him, and I'm not sure who got the better of it. Then the captain came along and looked at us all, and we looked at him, and that's basically the objective of divisions, is so that you know him and he knows you. And basically, it's a good thing.
Did you ever experience any ceremonies crossing the equator?
Oh, crossing the line, yes. Oh dear, we had to cross the line. Oh my, yes. I was a young tearaway in those days, I suppose. That's a job to remember. Think of myself as a tearaway, exactly. I suppose I was. And we had all the bath set up, and the black soot, and the painting of soap, and the Neptune, and the whole works set up on the catapult deck. And everybody was, and the Neptune's handymen, or whatever they're called, were going round the messes, clearing people out to come along and be done. And I wasn't going to be done, and I was in the mess, and I could hear them coming along the corridor, banging on doors and saying, "Come along, all you lot, you landlubbers, you've got to be swashed." And so I climbed out of the porthole, and we were in the middle of the Indian Ocean, remember? I climbed out of the porthole, and I put my hand up and caught hold of the guardrail above, and hauled myself on the outside of the ship, outside of the guardrail, up onto the deck above, and shot along the deck to get out of the way of the ceremony of being done with soot and water and shaving soap and all the rest of it. And I remember that with horror to this day, because it was an exceedingly dangerous thing to do. One slip and I would have been into the ocean and the man overboard. But I got away with it, and there you are. That's what sort of thing you do when you're 21 or 2. Not nowadays, though, by Jove.
So did you get away?
I got away with it. I went, I got away without being done, and I wasn't given a certificate. But I was given a certificate in my next commission, when we went to the East Indies, and we had the same thing all over again, and I submitted to the indignities, and I got a certificate. So I've got one after all. And in latter years, I've been on a cruise and crossed the line, and I've got another certificate. So there.
Any other memories of the Belfast, or any particular traditions?
Yes, one that I find exceedingly irritating. Every time it went into harbour, all the decks were cleared. Everybody had to keep out of the way, out of sight. All the portholes had to be shut. You weren't allowed to even peek your nose round the corner, and the selected few men stood on the front on the forecastle, and the selected few men stood on the quarter deck. The captain stood on his bridge, and you went into harbour as if there was nobody about at all. And I never ever saw any harbours in the way that I would like to have seen them. In latter years, I've been on cruises, and it has been the greatest delight to me to sit out on the outside cafe and have breakfast whilst we're going into a harbour, such as Malta, which I have been in many times in the Navy and never saw a single thing, never had one single glimpse of it, from seabird, that is. So that's a routine that I found exceedingly irritating. Another routine of marking respect to other ships passing is the dipping of the flag, and in going in going into harbour, sometimes firing the saluting gun. But nothing else comes to mind.
Any other memories of the Belfast or her company?
There's one memory that sticks out of the European conflict. You remember in 1941 the ship had its back broken and was repaired. Well, subsequent to that, its shape changed slightly. It twisted, and one of the propeller shafts got out of line of its bearings, and in a harbour in Iceland, Seyðisfjörður, I believe, we had to work all night and all day and all night again, unbolting this bearing and realigning it to the propeller shaft, and this is in a little hole down in the depths of the bottom of the ship, where you could only get two or three chaps around it at once. Unship this whole bearing and lift it up and put it in its correct position and repack it down again. And that was my introduction to real ship's engineering when I suppose I was barely 20 at the time. And it's that sort of thing that I looked forward to in the latter half of my life, was to be getting on with real engineering, and to be on a ship which had, to quote an example, we went for 3 weeks with one boiler unusable, so we only had three boilers out of four, which to me was a heinous crime. But nobody seemed to bother very much. And that's what eventually sent me out of the Navy. I'm getting ahead of myself.
That wasn't on the Belfast?
No, on another ship.
Do you remember much about your arrival back in the UK with the Belfast?
Funnily enough, no. I suppose that I had nobody to come back particularly to, my family, yes, but none of my family came to meet the ship. I scarcely expected them to. Mum and Dad were quite old. They were 42 when I was born, so they were 42 years older than me, and so they would be getting on towards their 70s and wouldn't have got there to the ship, and my siblings were all scattered round the four winds, and I had no girls, so I had nobody to meet me, and I was anxious to do something on shore, because I'd been 5 years at sea, something on shore, and quite soon after we arrived back, a notice went up saying anybody who would like to consider themselves as an instructor for the RNVR, would they put their names in? And I put my name in, and I was accepted, and I went off almost straight away to be an instructor with the Sussex Division of the Royal Naval Volunteer Reserves.
Can you tell me when that was?
That would be in 1948, back end of 1948, middle of 1948. I did an instructor's course and went straight down to New Haven, where I got myself a room to live, and I worked in the RNVR base in New Haven, and lived in this room. I also went across to Hove to talk in the base in Hove, because the division was in two places, New Haven and Hove. And there I was for 2 years.
Ronald, Jesse, Real 8. What was it like coming back to England after such a long absence in the Far East?